Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll discuss the potential for a resurgence of COVID-19 and what metrics will health officials be watching. If your organization doesn't already recognize Juneteenth as a holiday, it may only be a matter of time before it does.
People are anxious to do something. This is one of the ways they can do it, and it's a fairly simple way, I would say, to say to your Black staff that we have heard you and we want to be part of the solution.
And the coronavirus has put more of a focus on the food supply. That's why many are now growing their own. That and more this hour on Statewide. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll get a lesson about Juneteenth, which some companies are now making a paid holiday. We'll also hear about efforts in Chicago to close the racial equity gap when it comes to coronavirus cases. And food deserts aren't only in major cities. We'll learn how some smaller communities are dealing with the problem. That and more ahead. Society is reopening a little bit at a time, but there remains a concern over a second wave of COVID-19, and the problem is, how will we know? Joe Marr is a Chicago Tribune reporter. He's looked at this, and he joins us now. And Joe, thanks for being with us.
All right, thanks for having me.
You've written about the metrics that state health officials will be watching, and one of those is number of cases. Let's talk about that. More testing, well, that likely means we're going to see more cases, more than will show up. So how can we judge that? Is that really a good metric to use for determining whether COVID-19 is on the rise?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, and that's the challenge with that number, right? That number is readily available. It's what we see all the time being posted, this number of new cases and all that kind of stuff. Dilemma is because testing hasn't been consistent throughout this whole process. And remember the days when, you know, it was hard to get a test for anybody unless they were very, very sick. We don't have a good baseline to compare that to. So it's not really the number that the experts will look at. They'll look at it. I mean, it's important if it starts to shoot up, right? But it's not the thing that they're going to focus on.
So daily hospital admissions, that's another metric. That one seems to be a little more reliable then.
Yeah, and of course the hospitalizations are just a subset of cases of people who get sick enough to be hospitalized. But the good news is that that figure has been relatively consistently kept, right? If you were sick enough to go to the hospital 2 or 3 months ago, you went to the hospital. So we do know those numbers, and we can compare them over time. The bad news is that that's what they call a lagging indicator. So by the time you're sick enough to go to the hospital, the infection's been in you a week or two, and that means that you may have infected other people and so forth. So it can be hard to get a real-time analysis based on that number.
And you also write about something that's called the R factor. So explain what that is.
Yeah, the R factor, it's one of these obscure terms that you wouldn't really know about unless you're either in the middle of a pandemic or you study this for a living. The R factor basically is the factor of the infection. So, and it's easy to understand in the sense that if it's above one, it's bad. If it's below one, it's good. That means how many people that if you have this virus, how many people are you going to infect before it runs its course? So if it's two, that means you'll infect two people. If it's less than one, that means the average person infects less than one person. So eventually it'll die out. So that's the good news about the R factor is once you figure it out, it's easy to understand. The bad news, the hard part is figuring it out. It takes a lot of math. There's a lot of complicated algebra behind it, and there's some debate about the best way to do it.
Joe, when we first started talking about COVID-19 and the concerns, the stay-at-home order, all of that was put into place, the discussion was really on intensive care unit capacity, beds that were available. Are we not looking at that anymore as a determining factor?
Oh, I think those factors are important for looking at whether we're getting overwhelmed. And I think when this first started, the focus was, we don't know what this beast is out there. How are we going to make sure we do not get overwhelmed by it? So capacity is an important thing to look at. What the experts will tell you is capacity is not a very good window into seeing whether the virus is resurging. It can give you a window into that. But the dilemma is you may be in the hospital for one day, you may be in the hospital for weeks, you may be in the hospital for a lot longer. So just measuring capacity by itself, you don't know if the capacity is big because somebody's been in there for a while or if the capacity is big because a bunch of people just showed up. And what they're trying to get is more precision on how quickly this thing may be spreading.
Joe Marr is a Chicago Tribune reporter, and we're talking about some of the things to watch for a potential second wave of COVID-19. And I've heard people say, Joe, that forget about a second wave, we're still in the first wave. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, there are some people who talk about this, the plateau effect is what they will talk about, is that, you know, they were expecting this dramatic curve. We would shoot up and then we'd go down like a roller coaster. And what happened in Illinois is that we plateaued for a while. We shot up and we stayed there for a while. I do think if you look at the figures, we have come down. I think there's an argument to be made that we're no longer plateauing. We are coming down. So I think there's an argument that there could be a wave that could come. But I do see the argument that we're still pretty hot and heavy in this. Where we're at basically in mid to late March. But mid to late March wasn't that great either.
Well, despite all this, I know that the state seems likely to move on to phase four, where we can see things like larger groups gathering. Restaurants can have in-person or a dining inside with some social distancing. But that seems like that's going to lead to more of the rise of these metrics. Even since we've moved into phase three, are we noticing that? Are we noticing that there that some of these different factors you're talking about have actually gone up?
What we're noticing is good news. Some of the stuff is going to be lagging, so I think the jury's still out on some of this. We had the demonstrations, we had the reopening, lots of different balls in the air. We also have people wearing masks, right? And there's a real debate about how much that's going to affect it. So we don't really know exactly the effects of all this stuff, but the good news is that the numbers that we're seeing are not spiking up, at least in Illinois.
So even though it's not spiking up, that also sends a message to a lot of people that maybe the worst is over, maybe I don't have to take these precautions. I know some of the doctors and other health officials you talked with are concerned about that factor, that people may not take this seriously. If we start to see, like you said, the plateau effect or even some of the numbers going down.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to know, is that while I think in human nature, we're kind of wired in a way where we hope that we have a crisis, we get through it, and whew, it's over, right? But the health experts that you talk to, the academics, the people that do this for a living, they don't share that ease about this, right? They're still very concerned. This is something that they don't quite feel like they have the best handle on, right? So while the numbers are good now, they don't know what could set this thing off again. So they are very cautious.
And not only that, I think you also mentioned in your article that a real issue is, let's say we get to a point where things are going pretty far south and we need to possibly move back, put more restrictions in place. Is there really a plan to do that or a way to determine that it's time to do that?
Right now it's vague, and I think that is probably a political hot potato, right? Because there is this tension between reopening the economy, people want their livelihoods and they want their lives back, and this tension of health experts saying, well, we've got to be prepared if this thing does go south, what we're going to do. And right now the state is saying if there are, quote-unquote, sustained bad numbers, they can move back, right? What does sustained mean? That hasn't been defined yet.
What is something people should pay attention to and know about the current situation and possibly going forward?
I think the one thing to keep in mind is that we don't have true random sampling going on right now. You know, you think of like political polling, right? Well, maybe not the 2016 race, but beyond that, traditional political polling, right? We have random sampling. We generally have a good feel for what people are thinking, what people are doing. So we have a good kind of horse race indicator. For this virus, we don't have that right now. We don't have the kind of random sampling that we would need to know exactly where it's at, exactly whether it's getting worse or getting better. What we have are these metrics that are kind of like looking at a mirror from another mirror, right? We can maybe get a decent idea of what's going on, but we still don't have completely arms around that. So I think for now, we have to be careful about assuming we're out of the woods yet.
That's Joe Murray. He's a Chicago Tribune reporter. He joined us here on Statewide. And Joe, thanks for being with us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
With police brutality in the news, parents may be wondering how to talk to their children about racism and white supremacy. These are conversations that are familiar to black families, but University of Illinois professors Shardae Smith and Helen Neville say all families should be having them. Lee Gaines spoke with Smith and Neville about best practices for both parents and educators. She started by asking Smith when parents should start having conversations about race with their children and how to make them age appropriate.
Parents should start having these conversations really early. We know that children as young as even 3 years old can recognize and develop racial attitudes and biases. So at an earlier age, exposing children to books and art with appropriate cultural representation and instilling these positive racial messages and engaging children in culturally diverse activities. And then as they get older, you may add in, particularly for Black children, some of these preparation for bias messages and begin to have a dialogue about the meaning of race in society and to make sure that you're open enough to answer any questions that they may have. And a lot of times when we're talking about racial socialization, many times it is the Black families that have been doing these types of parenting approaches, but this can be for non-Black families as well, and it should be because they're also living in this society. And when they are learning how to call out or recognize injustices or racial practices from their parents, and then they would be equipped to be able to engage in anti-racist approaches as they get older as well. And these conversations will become more complex over time. But when parents convey that they are open to having these difficult conversations, then kids are going to be more likely to disclose their experiences and feelings to them. And I will say that parents know their children best. And so they'll be able to fill out when is an appropriate time. But we have to keep in mind that children are going to learn about this one way or another. It's about how can we shape that narrative, and what and how they learn can be shaped by parents in a supportive family environment. And so starting earlier will be best because it will, you know, they'll face that reality.
Talking about race is something Black families and some non-Black families have been doing for a long time. But for white families, this might not be a conversation they're having. It's like a muscle they haven't exercised at all. Dr. Neville, what is your advice to white families who haven't had these conversations with their kids but want to start?
So the first thing that we have to do is to begin to, that folks need to begin to educate themselves about the role of race and racism and how it operates throughout history and operates in our daily lives. There's two kind of approaches to colorblind racial beliefs. One is where people want to just say, oh, I don't notice what race you are. We're all the same. And that could be called like this color evasion approach. And the other kind of racial colorblindness is this idea of not noticing or seeing racism. So the idea, you know, you could see and hear about the horrific murder of George Floyd and say, oh, race didn't have anything to do with it. So the first part I think is important is for parents to begin to get on their journey about educating themselves about race, racial oppression, and anti-Blackness in our society. And so I think that gets folks ready to have these open conversations in which they can be fully present for their children. It's important for people to know that they don't need to know everything, that they can be open with their child and say, you know, I'm just beginning to explore this myself, but let's have a conversation. This allows children to know that they can have difficult conversations in the home and that race is not a taboo topic.
I think it's also important to note that parents and guardians aren't the only adults in their children's lives. Dr. Smith, what can teachers do when they're asked questions about racism and police brutality?
So when teachers are asked questions about racism and police brutality, they can first and foremost acknowledge their question. You can say things like, you know, thank you for asking me that question. I want to answer you, but first I want to know more about what you know. And teachers can then acknowledge what kids know and validate their feelings, their thought process, the confusion or whatever may come out of the question in order to answer their questions in an age-appropriate way, as well as provide additional resources, developmentally appropriate resources that can help them grasp these complicated issues. And so I think when teachers, you know, shy away or put it off onto parents, they're sending a message that this does not belong here and this is not a conversation that we should have here, when in fact it is, and they're a primary socializing agent, just like parents are.
Dr. Neville, do you have anything to add? What about high school teachers and even college professors?
Sometimes what happens is that teachers then rely on the Black students or the other students of color in the classroom to speak up on these issues. And so the idea is that the teacher would not look to these students to educate other students. The second issue is that when these discussions of race and racism and police brutality, these are emotional conversations that come up in the classroom that sometimes can go sideways in ways that you never expected. And so when you shy away from having those difficult conversations, that can actually do more harm, particularly to Black students and other students of color in the classroom. So really, teachers can continue to gain their skills in having how to have these courageous conversations, and then also to learn skills to call out racism or microaggressions that could actually happen in the classroom that then can further harm students of color where they feel silenced, invalidated, and not understood.
That's U of I Professor of Educational Psychology and African American Studies, Helen Neville, speaking with reporter Lee Gaines. We also heard from U of I Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies, Shardae Smith. There's more of Statewide coming up. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. Ahead, we'll hear how some central Illinois communities are combating the problem of food deserts. And remember, you can find links to all of our stories at statewideshow.com and catch our podcast through the NPR One app. Illinois has canceled its state fairs this year in both Springfield and DuQuoin. In a video announcement posted online, State Fair Manager Kevin Gordon says the decision stems from the uncertainty of the coronavirus pandemic.
If the Illinois State Fair were to be held today, it would not be the same fair you have all come to know and love. And bottom line, the safety of our fairgoers is first and foremost and would never be compromised.
Next summer's fairs are still scheduled to take place and should have more exhibits and upgrades. Many employers in Illinois and across the country are offering a new paid day off this year, Juneteenth, and it falls on June 19th each year. It commemorates the day in 1865 when many slaves in Texas learned they had been freed. That was 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. It's been a day of celebration and reflection for African Americans, but it's only now gaining more widespread acknowledgement. Odette Youssef with WBEZ brings us more.
Akile Parnell has taken Juneteenth off for years.
But even as, you know, African-American from Birmingham, Alabama, it wasn't something that was just widely celebrated.
Parnell says typically he'd take the day off to read something about slavery, the struggle for Black liberation, and to reflect on the legacy of slavery. In the past, it's been a pretty solitary exercise.
But even in, you know, many, you know, African-American communities, it's not as widely celebrated. I think that will change from here on out.
Why? Because now more Americans are expressly being given Juneteenth off. Parnell's own small organization, the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, is among them. Same goes for other organizations, big and small. AbbVie, the biotech giant headquartered in Chicago, is giving its 47,000 employees a paid day off. Northfield-based insurance company Allstate is doing the same.
People are
anxious to do something.
Mary Morton is president of Morton Group, a national consulting firm that helps clients on issues around racial equity, diversity, and inclusion. Morton says it's great that many companies are issuing public statements to support Black Lives Matter after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. But she says at this moment, the public is demanding action, not just lip service.
This is one of the ways they can do it. And it's a fairly simple way, I would say, to say to your Black staff that we have heard you and we want to be part of the solution.
In fact, Morton says the trend may be reaching a point where employers who don't offer Juneteenth off may have to address that.
I think it will be incumbent upon them to have conversations with their staff about why they have not, but maybe they're looking to do that in the future, or just what the concerns are.
Morton says whether or not an employer offers Juneteenth off, work remains. She encourages them to gather their teams to discuss racial equity realities and solutions in their workplace. Tracy Baim is publisher of the Chicago Reader. She says recognition of Juneteenth is long overdue.
You know, it's interesting how society changes in bursts, both small and big. I feel like a lot of the things that happened the last 2 weeks were things that were 30, 40 years in the planning.
Baim says she doesn't completely understand it all, but she wonders if the convergence of major events, the pandemic, Floyd's killing, widespread unemployment, has driven this shift in societal norms. Whatever it is, she's encouraging Black employees to rest. And
for the white employees, I do hope that they take the opportunity to learn more about Juneteenth and maybe do some amplification of Black Lives Matter and other organizations that are doing the work in the streets, whether protesting or feeding people.
And if you're new to all this, Akile Parnell, the lawyer who's been observing Juneteenth for years, has a reading suggestion. It's something he traditionally reads on July 4th instead of celebrating Independence Day. It's Frederick Douglass's speech, titled, What to the Slave is the 4th of July? Odette Youssef, WBEZ News.
For many Missouri inmates, family visits are an essential lifeline to the outside world. But 3 months ago, the Department of Corrections in that state suspended all in-person visits to keep the coronavirus from spreading within the prison system. It's unclear when those visits will resume, and that's left families feeling anxious about their incarcerated loved ones. For St. Louis Public Radio, Shayla Farzan brings us this story.
Back in February, Tina Merriweather and her great-granddaughter took a two-hour bus trip from their home in St. Louis to the women's prison in Vandalia. They were visiting Merriweather's daughter, LaToy Williams, like they do every month. And that visit in February felt like any other. Williams colored a picture of a puppy with her granddaughter, sipped root beer, laughed with her mom. She didn't know it at the time, but it would be her last family visit for months. In March, the Missouri Department of Corrections suspended all in-person visitation due to the pandemic.
I was just really frantic, like calling home, making sure my grandbaby was wearing her masks, making sure she's staying in. You know, it was just like a real thing.
She's been an inmate at the prison for a year and a half, and she says seeing her family helps her feel less anxious, gives her something to look forward to. At first, William says she didn't really take the virus seriously. But then there was a suspected case of COVID-19 in her housing unit, and everyone was quarantined.
You know, they came over there like immediately, come on, just go, leave your things. And then when we get over there, I mean, they in like the full body masks, it's like the white suit on, like, you know, I'm like, wow, what is happening?
Since March, about 50 Missouri inmates and 40 employees have tested positive for the coronavirus, and one inmate has died. The cases have mostly been at Southeast Correctional Center, a maximum security men's prison south of Cape Girardeau. Sitting in a folding chair on her porch, William's mom, Tina Merriweather, says she worries her daughter might get sick. And when they talk on the phone, she tells her, wear your mask, wash your hands. Merriweather never knows exactly when her daughter will call, so she carries her phone with her everywhere, just in case.
I could be out here taking care of business and she'll call me. I can be having a prayer service and stuff and she'll call me. I miss her so much.
She'll have to wait a while longer to see her daughter. This week, the DOC extended the visiting suspension through at least June 21st. A spokesperson said they're conducting mass testing of inmates and staff. Joyce Arditi is a professor at Virginia Tech who studies incarceration and family relationships. She says there's already a lot of hurdles to visiting family members in prison.
It's stigmatized. There's not a lot of social support for doing this. It's not like visiting grandma in the hospital or the nursing home or other kinds of institutions where people tend to provide, you know, support.
And she adds that families with incarcerated loved ones also tend to be lower income and may be facing other challenges during the pandemic, challenges that could make it harder for them to keep in touch by phone or even maintain a relationship at all.
So these are families that also might be dealing with hardships around employment, income loss, health risks, testing, etc. So you've kind of got a perfect storm here.
Given all that, many inmates are worried about the health of their families on the outside. At the prison in Vandalia, inmate Michelle Hickman says she burst into tears when she heard that she wouldn't be able to see her husband and three kids.
It's not easy being in here alone and knowing there's nothing you can do for them out there.
Hickman says tensions are high inside the prison, partly because people miss their families. But she's scared that she might be putting her family at risk if they were to visit.
I'm like, do I want my visit back? Yes. But I also want to concern myself with the safety of my children and other families as well as people in here. You know, so it's like, how do you move forward with something like that?
Every day she waits in line, sometimes for an hour, to get a 15-minute phone call with her family. She says just hearing their voices, knowing they're okay, is what's keeping her going. I'm Shayla Farzan.
Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. COVID-19 has caused disruptions in how families get their food. That's one reason more people are now growing their own. Chase Kavanaugh has details.
The concept of a victory garden dates to the Second World War. Food was in high demand, and canned food was rationed for the war effort. Sarah Vogel is an educator at the University of Illinois Extension.
We started to see committees formed within individual neighborhoods. We saw tools shared, food was grown, and a real sense of community and patriotism was encouraged at that time.
Vogel says this effort paid off significantly.
And by 1943, American Victory Gardens generated nearly 40% of all produce in the U.S.
COVID-19 has created a growing interest in planting these types of gardens. DeKalb County Community Gardens founder Dan Kenny explains.
The COVID impact on various food distribution networks have affected people to the point of where they're concerned about where their food's coming from, and they want to try to have more control over their food system and have more control over where they are able to access their food.
But knowledge of gardening is less widespread than it was in the 40s, especially in urban populations. Vogel says institutions like U of I Extension can change that.
This should be our opportunity to teach and help each other become more self-reliant.
Kenny says this has also been happening at his organization, which, among other things, provides education on gardening as well as community growing space.
Young folks coming out, that made their first time to garden, and so they are very eager to learn how to grow their own food.
When it comes to starting a garden, both Vogel and Kenny recommend starting with a small patch and expanding from there. Gardens at ground level are easier to maintain, but Kenny says a raised garden bed has a different advantage.
Many people don't realize that weed seeds live in the ground for hundreds of years, and when you till the ground and till those weed seeds up, it becomes quite a problem. Whereas if you use a raised garden bed, then you don't have to till the soil, and you're able to manage the weeds much easier.
As for plants, Kenny says the soil is fertile enough around northern Illinois that one should be able to grow what they want to eat. Vogel adds that an ideal plant for beginning gardeners is tomatoes. She says they're quick to grow, and you can potentially get 200 tomatoes from one plant.
The one downfall is they are perishable. So that's when you start thinking about canning or freezing or making your salsa or spaghetti sauce, but you can make a lot of different food from tomatoes.
The one crop Kenny advises against growing is sweet corn.
We have a lot of places around here that sell sweet corn, and we have plenty of it, and raccoons also love sweet corn.
Kenny says a common mistake first-time gardeners make is overwatering their plants. He recommends the finger test.
They stick their finger in the soil, and the soil sticks to their finger. They don't need to water. If it doesn't stick to their finger and falls right off, then they should water a little bit.
And when weeds do pop up, Vogel says to address them immediately.
Everybody hates weeding, but it's got to be done, because if you don't, they will essentially steal the nutrients from the rest of the plants that you want to keep.
Kenny adds that along with the crop that's raised, the activity has material and social benefits.
I encourage people to consider gardening if they haven't gardened in the past. And I think they'll feel well rewarded for their efforts.
The number of people gardening, like the wild plants around the state, is likely to grow even more. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
Once a neighborhood or town becomes a food desert, it's difficult to restore a functional food system. Tim Shelley of WCBU tells us how two central Illinois communities are trying to grow new food networks.
The small town of Mount Pulaski is tucked into the southeastern corner of rural Logan County, roughly halfway between Decatur and Springfield. At the center of the town square sits one of just two remaining courthouses where a young Abraham Lincoln practiced law. At first glance, Mount Pulaski doesn't have much in common with Peoria's South Side, an urban neighborhood about an hour's drive to the northwest. Census Bureau records show the largely African-American community is one of America's poorest zip codes. But both communities lack a grocery store. South Peoria's Save-A-Lot grocery store closed in 2017. Two Kroger stores in nearby neighborhoods closed a year later. Leslie McKnight, Director of Community Health Policy and Planning for the Peoria City County Health Department, says the South Side has a high poverty rate and a high incidence of health risk factors like obesity.
In that 1 mile area of that neighborhood, their grocery options is dollar stores and convenience stores.
Tom Martin, a farmer and president of the Market on the Hill Grocery Co-op Board in Mount Pulaski, says the city's last grocery store closed up shop in 2016.
Logan County has been labeled as the most obese county in the state of Illinois.
The US EPA selected Peoria and Mount Pulaski for its Local Foods, Local Places program last year. The program tries to help communities restore local food systems and boost economic opportunities and health outcomes. In Peoria, Leslie McKnight says the local neighborhood organization, Southside Community United for Change, worked to set up a farmer's market pilot project in an old Aldi parking lot.
What that means is that the residents were on the front end of the planning, the marketing, and the outreach. And as institutional stakeholders, we were on the back end providing support and capacity.
The Southside Farmer's Market offered fresh produce on 3 weekends last fall. 12 vendors sold goods. It was a learning experience. Some aspects, like a partnership with an organic farmer, proved too expensive to be sustainable. The concept evolved into something neighborhood thinks is doable, a food equity hub. It would include not only the purchasing, packaging, and selling of locally produced foods, but also cooking classes, nutritional education, and workforce development efforts. It also became a focal point to organize the area's informal economy of vendors. In March, the Community Foundation of Central Illinois gave the Southside Farmers Market a $30,000 grant to expand to a 10-week season this year. Martha Ross is president of Southside Community United for Change. She says this feels different than the top-down approaches tried before.
This isn't just another plan, because I've participated with the city of Peoria on many, many plans, and they just go on the shelf. But this is a plan. This is our plan.
That sense of community ownership is also pivotal for Mount Pulaski. Market on the Hill Board President Tom Martin says co-ownership by residents is key to co-op success.
It's all about grassroots driven, and you've got to have the community behind you before you ever step into this.
Martin says he's been blessed to have that community support, though the pandemic has delayed the store's opening. The Market on the Hill will be in an old storefront on the city square. The grocery will partner with Kyle Reed's 5-acre Hilltop Community Gardens on the northwest edge of Mount Pulaski for locally grown veggies and fruit. Food processing may eventually happen. Martin says he'll be happy when the open sign finally goes up, but says the ultimate challenge is to turn a profit. He believes community backing will make it possible to capture 15-20% of Southern Logan County's grocery market. Martin advocates a wait-and-see approach for other communities who might want to emulate the Mount Pulaski model.
My best advice is sit back, let us make the mistakes, but then hopefully we can show you the way to succeed, so it makes it a little bit easier for you to do something like this.
But in Peoria, Health Department Health Policy and Planning Director Leslie McKnight says it's also important to make the initial effort.
You got to just go out there and innovation, just try it, test it, model it, pilot it, and just see what happens.
To grow into a food equity hub, the volunteer-driven farmers market needs to partner with the Community Development Corporation to begin hiring employees. Neighborhood Association President Martha Ross says the pilot is evidence to convince doubters.
We're constantly getting people who say, well, this is not going to work. They never did anything before. Well, We're not talking about they now. We're talking about us. If it is to be, it's up to me.
Since the pandemic began, Market on the Hill has hired two people to explore joining a food hub and processing center in Mount Pulaski. The Southside Project in Peoria continues early planning with the Greater Peoria Economic Development Council. I'm Tim Shelley.
You're listening to Statewide. We have more ahead. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, an unseen problem caused by the coronavirus. The Illinois High School Association Board has approved Champaign-Urbana's bid to host the boys' basketball state finals for the next 3 years. That moves those games from Peoria. Jim Meadows explains.
The tournament, for which the name March Madness was coined, was held on the University of Illinois' Urbana campus for 78 years until moving to Peoria in 1996. Jane DeLuce with the tourism group Visit Champaign County says that back then the community may have taken its hold on the tournament for granted.
I use the word a little bit of complacency, where we never thought that the tournament would leave Champaign-Urbana. And people today are dedicated and passionate about keeping it here forever.
The tournament will be played at the U of I's State Farm Center, known as the Assembly Hall, when it last hosted the games. IHSA Executive Director Craig Anderson says major renovations at the center helped win over board members. I'm Jim Meadows.
The IHSA also voted this week to keep the girls' basketball state finals at Illinois State's Redbird Arena in Normal. We know COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting minority communities and people of color. Chicago's Mayor Lori Lightfoot has called it a public health red alarm. She's working with community groups to create what she calls a racial equity rapid response team. Here's more from NPR's Cheryl Corley.
Auburn Gresham is a predominantly African-American working-class bungalow belt neighborhood on Chicago's South Side. It's seen its share of troubles, high unemployment, gang warfare, and then came the wrath of COVID-19. In March, Illinois officials announced a retired nurse who lived in the neighborhood was the first in the state to die from coronavirus. Patricia Friesen was 61. Her older sister, Wanda Bailey, died from the virus days later. Here on 79th Street, a drive-in test site opened up recently.
Well, this is critical. You know, we've been screaming for weeks to get testing here in Auburn Gresham.
Carlos Nelson is the head of a community group, the Greater Auburn Gresham Development Corporation. He says it's been dire here, with more than 1,000 confirmed coronavirus cases.
We're dying because we don't have the same resources or access to information.
And African Americans in Chicago have died from COVID-19 at a rate about 3 times higher than the city's white residents. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot says the racial gap is unacceptable and the result of a racist system that for generations left black neighborhoods with little access to health care, jobs, education, and healthy food. Conditions, she adds, that aren't unique to Chicago.
We're seeing this manifest in large urban areas with large black populations all over the United States. Milwaukee, Cleveland, Detroit, and other places are experiencing the same thing, but we are going to step up and do something about it.
Distributing free masks, hundreds of door hangers, and thousands of postcards about COVID-19 are part of the effort by the Racial Equity Rapid Response Team. There's also a push to address long-standing issues like food insecurity, especially in places like Auburn Gresham, where unemployment is nearly 30%.
Anyone without a ticket, I'm going to send them to the left.
Recently, hundreds of people on foot and in cars lined the blocks for a pop-up food pantry run by Carlos Nelson's group and the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Volunteers helped Carolyn Bowers load boxes of canned goods, meat, and produce into a cart. Bowers works part-time caring for seniors and says COVID-19 has caused lots of financial havoc.
I'm not able to service as many clients as I have been because a lot of the seniors, they're afraid to let the workers come into their home.
She's been working 8 hours a week instead of her typical 30 to 35, but Bowers considers herself lucky since she and her adult children live with her mother and everyone chips in. COVID-19 is now most prevalent in Chicago's Latinx neighborhoods. There's the same push to educate people about the pandemic with bilingual messaging and also a focus on workplaces where there's been a cluster of coronavirus cases. Unions are part of the outreach effort. Efren Elias is the vice president of SEIU Local 1. It represents janitors, security officers, and others.
These are workers who are heading to the front lines of this crisis to keep the public clean, safe, and healthy every day. And our workers are not able to stay at home.
Hey, good morning, guys.
The vacuum cleaner dies down as Javier Flores goes over the day's cleaning schedule with his maintenance crew at a nearly 200-unit residential building.
Thank God we haven't had any type of cases here or any type of incidents whatsoever.
Flores says both he and his wife are essential employees. She is a cook for the Chicago Public Schools and prepares free breakfast and lunch for students that families pick up. The couple live with their two young daughters in Chicago's Belmont-Craven area. With more than 3,000 confirmed cases, it's one of the Latinx communities with the most coronavirus cases in the state. And that makes Flores anxious.
My youngest daughter started coughing and telling me that her throat hurts, you know, and I can't avoid just thinking about COVID-19.
His daughter was fine, and Flores hopes the city's racial equity work will help make that true for so many others in communities of color hard hit by the COVID-19 pandemic.
That's Cheryl Corley with that report. Many people turn to their faith during uncertain times. Illinois faith communities are making sure their members are supported. Yvonne Booz has details.
Open thou the door.
George Davis is a member of the local spiritual assembly Baha'is of Rockford. Davis says the Baha'i National Spiritual Assembly offered guidance for both COVID-19 precautions and handling the death of George Floyd. He says the organization has focused on making sure the community is safe from the coronavirus by following regulations put in place by state and health officials.
We've continued to have daily devotionals that are offered on Zoom for anyone who wants to participate.
He says this new way of coming together is beneficial.
I would say that in many ways, our interactions and our connections have increased and deepened.
Scott Hodge is the lead pastor of the Orchard Community in Aurora. He says he thinks his congregation is adapting well to worshiping during COVID-19. Hodge says Zoom is used for weekly fellowship, but they use the church online platform for its services.
The first week we did it, someone sent me a text of someone from our church, and they were telling me how much they loved having the ability to fast forward through the church service. And so I figured out really quickly how to shut that off so they can't do it.
Hodge says the technology is great and the flow of the service is the same.
It feels very similar to what our gathering in person would be. You know, we start off with a welcome and how to log in, and we do a call to worship, we do some music, we do some prayers.
Davis says the Baha'i members are receiving the same musical experience they did before COVID-19.
Yeah, you know, the Baha'i faith is very much focused on the spiritual richness of all of the arts and expressions.
Davis suggests that technology has allowed the continuation of the 19-day feast. This gathering happens every 19 days. He shares the importance of this meeting.
For prayer and for reflection and really also for conversation about the concerns that are on the minds and hearts of the Baha'i community.
Outside of COVID-19, race relations are high on that list of concerns. He says the death of George Floyd has put an urgency on the need for these conversations.
You know, the Baha'i teachings are very clear that both Black and white Americans in this country have a direct responsibility for addressing the conflicts that come up with regard to race, but our responsibilities are different.
Davis is African American. He says his community should see themselves as contributors and not victims. Hodge is white. He is also having conversations with his parishioners about racism. Hodge says it's been the topic of his last two sermons. He talks about the first being Pentecost Sunday.
And, you know, the whole emphasis is on the Holy Spirit. And there's this the Hebrew word and the Greek word for spirit is the word breath or to breathe. And I shared that and I talked about this word to breathe and breath. And I paused and I said, like, I can't breathe.
He explains that breath is a gift from God.
And to take that breath from another life is to take a piece of God.
Hodge says he understands things are complicated.
But God forbid that paralyzes us. and keeps us from standing up for and standing alongside our Black brothers and sisters right now.
Hodge has a coffee shop and event venue called Society 57. This is the same place church services are held. It's located in downtown Aurora, where a recent protest against police brutality turned into looting. He says he felt so many emotions. He's not only a pastor, but a shop owner who had to protect his business.
I felt it all. I felt sadness. I felt anger. I felt joy watching people come together.
Both Davis and Hodge say they are hopeful about the conditions of this country. They also say, although they are able to communicate with their members digitally, nothing will ever take the place of face-to-face human connection. I'm Yvonne Booz.
I want to encourage you to trust God like never before.
Throughout the pandemic, calls to the state's child abuse and neglect hotline have been down more than 50% compared to this time last year. Child advocates believe it's not a signal that fewer children are being harmed, but instead suggests children who are at risk are not being identified by people like school teachers and social workers. Betsy Goulet is a clinical assistant professor at the University of Illinois Springfield and a co-author of a recent report on this topic for the U of I Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And she spoke with Christine Herman about how teachers have gotten creative when it comes to reaching out to families and why she remains concerned.
They were making drive-bys, you know, they were doing visits on porches and driveways, and that was significant. But again, there were students who probably weren't coming out on the porch or the driveway. And the teachers that we've talked to have said that's what unnerves them, the lack of contact. People don't have their support systems in place. Even if they were getting services, mental health services, perhaps they were in some kind of support group, those kinds of things, they're all suspended. And it's just being really conscious of the way that this has impacted fragile families, the way that the economy has continued to create hardships. And with those hardships, sometimes that's the environment where we see maltreatment, we see depression, and we see, you know, some families who withdraw further and further. It becomes harder for them to deal with these changes.
How do you know when it's abuse and neglect versus simply a lack of access to food or a need for other supports or services? When does it warrant a call to the hotline?
That is the question that we're constantly training mandated reporters to know, that it's not for them to do an investigation. It's for them to report a suspicion and to allow DCFS and the trained investigators to sort through all of the information, all the facts that would then point them to that decision that something is happening. You know, it's not always clear cut. And we also know that children don't necessarily disclose in big chunks of information. And sometimes it is something that's a hint of a larger problem. All we ask of our mandated reporters is to make a report if they have a suspicion that a child might be even at risk of harm. And as you pointed out, you know, is the food issue, the insecurity with food, is it something that's happening because of neglect or because of a lack of funds in the home? You know, we don't consider poverty abuse or neglect. That's a condition that can create harm for kids, but it's also a condition that we can correct with services.
What about for people who don't trust the system for whatever reason?
Absolutely. There are all kinds of perceptions about DCFS. I kind of call them urban legends, you know, that even exist within other systems about DCFS. You know, law enforcement's perceptions, or the school, or the medical community. I've heard them all. I mean, I was a DCFS investigator. And so a lot of what I talk about and my perception of the importance and the value of mandated reporting comes from having done that job and knowing how critically important it is. But we have to support those people. We have to give them the training to understand how to do the job well. But they can only do their jobs if, as a community, we understand that children are harmed. There are people who do things to kids that need to be reported. And right now we're all feeling a little overwhelmed by what's happening and the fear that there is more of this going on and fewer people in the know.
That's U of I Springfield professor Betsy Goulet. She spoke with Christine Herman. And let's note the state's child abuse hotline number is 1-800-25-ABUSE. That's it for this episode of Statewide. We're glad you could join us and be with us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this episode or past shows, they're all available at statewideshow.com, and our podcast can be found through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.